You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good morning. I'd like to welcome everybody to this event that's jointly hosted by my program. I'm the director of the information program at the OS Open Society Institute, and by the Open Society Fellows program. I believe this is the maiden event organized by the Fellows program. There are roughly three stories that have been told in the last few years about the effects of online media, social media, new media on the public sphere, on democracy, on civic engagement. One is a kind of sunny, optimistic story. One example, a recent example, would be Don Tapscott, who's just published a new book on how young people engage online. And he claims that online media are making young people more collectively intelligent, more inclined to collaborate, more curious about the world than their TV watching, passive couch potato predecessors. There's also another story that's told that's much more pessimistic, almost dystopian. One example could be the journalist Andrew Keen, who's written a book called The Cult of the Amateur, about how the rise of user-generated content is driving out expertise. It's a kind of occupation of the public sphere by the horde story, to caricature it. And then there are a third set of stories that are more nuanced. I guess the most prominent example would be Cass Sunstein in his books Infotopia and Republic.com has acknowledged that new media are probably an enhancement of democracy and the public sphere, but they also bring new risks. In particular, the fragmentation of the public sphere into enclaves of the like-minded and polarization of separate echo chambers of people who egg one another on to more extreme views and have no interaction with those of different perspectives. But all of these stories are based on the experience of developed open societies like the United States or Western Europe, and they seem to take a fairly culturally uniform view of the world. They don't take account of the experience of very different cultures, and especially of the effects of these media in more repressive societies. There hasn't really been a lot of good work done on the effects of new media in those other parts of the world, like China, like Iran, like parts of the Arab world, Russia. So we have with us today a stellar cast of experts and commentators and academic researchers who are trying to provide that more nuanced picture of the effect of new media in those kinds of societies. And I'll introduce each one in turn as they speak. Our first speaker will be John Kelly, who's the founder of Morningside Analytics. He's an affiliate of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School and also the Oxford Internet Institute. And he's completing a PhD at Columbia University using innovative techniques that blend social network analysis, content analysis, and statistical analysis to create maps of online discourse and online activity in different parts of the world.
My turn?
Yeah.
Hi, folks. So all the work you're about to see kind of started with my dissertation work at Columbia on social network analysis of the English language blogosphere. And it's been a series of projects that have led me to in interesting directions, now looking at international blogospheres as well. And so we'll start out looking at some of the U.S. stuff to understand the system, kind of the way this way of looking at things. And then we'll move on and look at some other contexts, international contexts, where we've studied, including Iran, which we know the best. And en route, I'm hoping to portray a picture of how these networks are complicated, and it's not as simple mapping between authoritarian societies and closed down online public spheres. You can have authoritarian societies with very interesting, lively, engaged public spheres, and you can have some that don't necessarily have that. And kind of paint a picture of how complicated it is, but in a way also how hopeful. But I was warned that I can't just do my usual thing and show a lot of colorful maps that are fun and interesting. I need to talk a little bit about how this stuff can become useful or might be thought of as a useful tool as well. And so I thought I would start out with something on screen which we have which Morningside produced for the election, which is an example of what you could call kind of a socially intelligent meme tracker. So there are a lot of meme trackers out there that essentially find out what people are talking about online with some amount of force, the things that a lot of bloggers are linking to, et cetera, and kind of move those up on a list so you can go and see what the blogosphere is paying attention to. Most of those, however, treat the blogosphere as kind of one haystack, and they look at what across that whole haystack is popular. And what we do is map out the way that these online public spheres are not a single haystack. They're actually a lot of different haystacks. And each haystack has its own things that it thinks are cool. And so this is an example of a socially intelligent meme tracker. In this case, this one is designed to know the difference between liberals and conservatives. And we see a space here where every dot here represents a YouTube video. And left-right dimension is the proportion of liberal or conservative bloggers that are linking to it. And then how high it is on that graph is how many bloggers are right now linking to it right now on their front page if you went on the internet. And you can play the video, and you can also go and see the new ones versus the old ones. This is everything that's within a day, within a week, et cetera. So this is one way of taking the kinds of maps you're about to see and turning it into tools for understanding what parts of a network are paying attention to what. And that can be, so this is a specific one based around US politics, but it's arbitrary. It could be any different social groups that you want to see what they're paying attention to. So just that basic idea of socially intelligent meme tracker. So now let me try and start this. Please forgive me, I'm a Mac guy, and I'm having to figure out how to use this little, I don't know what they call these little red things, these little kind of joystick things. Okay.
Anathema,
yeah. Yes, a pain in the something. I don't know, is it possible to get these front lights down at all? Should have thought of this. No? That's good, thank you. So these are 12 different social network diagrams of online public spheres. Let me just describe a little bit about what's going on in these maps, and then we'll take a look deeper. So on these maps, every dot represents a blog or, you know, a blog-like thing. Somebody or an organization posting a sequence of posts in time. And they're drawn based on looking at the connections among these online entities. And so we end up seeing the shape of the network topology, which is a feature of the density of connections among these bloggers. Let's for now just call them bloggers. And something about this shape represents something about the society that's creating it, because these dense connections are because people are, for one reason or another, interested in similar things, and they're interested in linking to one another. So they arise around all kinds of organizing principles, from politics to cultural factors to what country you're living in, et cetera. And these are different around the world. Each one of these networks looks different because these societies are different. And what we're trying to do is figure out why. And hear what some of these languages are. So the first division we make is by language, because in the global network, and I want to stress this is a global network, there are a lot of connections, especially through expatriate bloggers and bilingual and multilingual bloggers, who connect public spheres across societies. I first saw this when studying the US technology blogosphere and kept noticing so many bloggers from other countries that were kind of the Uber geeks back in their own context, and they were camped onto the Silicon Valley streams of information, translating those back home. So you have these international information knowledge flows around technology, and you also find them around politics and other things as well. So I'll just kind of explain the method a little bit in reference to the English language blogosphere, because it's easy to explain. So this is the English, this is the top 8,000 blogs in the English language blogosphere organized using this method. So every dot here represents a blog. The size of the dot is how many other bloggers are linking to it. And its position is the function of a physics model in which, imagine there's a general force like a wind trying to blow all these dots off the map. And any two that are connected by having linked to each other are pulled together as though by a spring or a force of gravity. So these network neighborhoods curdle up around densely interconnected bloggers. And this is what it looks like. Secondarily, we put the color on the dot. And the color is a different thing. We monitor these blogs over time, and we look every day at what they're linking to, and then we study those link histories, what it is they've linked to, and we cluster those statistically to find bloggers that are paying attention to the same kinds of other online resources. And that's not just blogs, that's also news sources, NGOs, all kinds of things, everything they link to. So if you're the same color on this map, it means you're paying attention to the same kind of stuff as the other bloggers that are the same color. And then we figure out what it is that they're paying attention to and what they're writing about. And we try and put some labels on it to understand them. So English language is the largest structures are around American politics, conservative and liberal ideology. But you find British bloggers, you find technology bloggers, you find a lot of other things. Also smaller groupings around science, environment, parenting. Even if you look at just the political bloggers, you can find some really interesting groups. So there are legal bloggers and security, by which I mean kind of strategic foreign policy studies, who some are on the left and some are on the right, but they're basically elite practitioners or knowledge workers, if you will, that have are also camped onto similar streams of information that feed that network of practice, say around being a security or foreign policy expert, around being a lawyer, for instance. So we can detect these kinds of networks. Now, moving on from the English context, this idea of democracy in the networked public sphere, the extent to which these are more vibrant in authoritarian countries or not, it's worth noting that these networks have distinctly different structures in every society for reasons that have sometimes something to do with politics and other times something to do with something else, from the way their ISPs have evolved to how many countries are there that speak that language, et cetera. Just at a glance, you can see differences between the Persian or Farsi Iranian network and the Russian network. And we'll come back to the Russian later, but the Iranian blogosphere is the foreign language blogosphere that we know the best. There's a study that was released out of Berkman last April, which goes into great detail. It's about 80 pages, and it's a fascinating read, at least 20 pages of it. And it's worth checking out. And we did a lot of work to have not just this network, just the computational stuff, but to have Iranian citizens, for the most part, or some expats, some people that were working with us who wanted to read these and help us code them. So we did a whole layer of coding where we had people read these blogs and answer questions and tell us what was going on. And we would sit down, we, the sort of researchers on this, and on the Iranian day for the election of the Majlis, we sat there and we clicked around on this map and we looked at what people were writing about on that day, including some of the conservative bloggers. But once we put the attentive clustering on it, we can really see that the network breaks out into some different areas. And I know I'm under some time constraints, so I'll try and speed it up. We found that the part of the Iranian blogosphere you may have heard about, the common story has been that the Iranian blogosphere is dominated by young Democrats who oppose the regime, et cetera, et cetera. And that's certainly the story that you will hear from the people you're likely to talk to who are going to be bilingual or expatriate bloggers. That's the story that they tell because that's the story they know. There's a tendency of people in these networks, as in any kind of social network, to have a really good picture of the local topology. Who's in your neighborhood you understand really well. The people who are in another neighborhood you barely know exist. So taking this global view, we found some interesting things, that the Iranian blogosphere is a very rich and complex space in which the people that are most talked about are down here in the lower left-hand corner. It's the secular and expatriate group, the Reformist Politics group. Most of these folks are not expatriates, however, they are living in Iran. Upwards of about 85% of the ones we sampled were living inside Iran. And they are writing from a largely reformist or secular point of view. But there are other folks here, too. And interestingly, up in the upper left, there's a big cluster around poetry, the mostly ghazal, the kind of love poetry. There's a mixed network area that has everything from pop culture to kind of minority cultures and et cetera. Down in the lower right was probably the most interesting thing we found, which was the very religious, mostly pro-Islamist political and other bloggers in three very distinct groups. The ones talking about politics were the ones here in red called CONPOL, Conservative Politics. They are mostly, they're all very religious. They support the Supreme Leader. They do not, by any stretch, all support Ahmadinejad. There's a lot of very contentious debate among these folks, which we found to our surprise. The group 12ers are essentially, it's people who are very fervently supporting a very common Shia theological notion of a Mahdi, of the Mahdi, the 12th Imam, who will return to rule a perfect earth. It's kind of a analogous to the second coming of Christ, common belief. They are fervently expecting that to happen and waiting for it. It's a group that Ahmadinejad courts the approval of. And then there's another group, religious youth, the blue group there, which are mostly younger folks, often college students, that are nonetheless blogging from a very religious perspective. You can see where Ahmadinejad and Khatami's blog and website are in this map. This was overlaying some data from the Open Net Initiative, which is a collaboration with Berkman and Oxford and some other partners, which looks at what gets filtered where. So the on the left, the blogs you see lit up there are the ones that are not visible inside Iran. The government is blocking those. And on the right are the ones that are visible. So unsurprisingly, the government blocks more in this secular reformist area. But surprisingly, most of the ones in that area are nonetheless visible to people inside Iran. And also, the third point is that the reformist stuff is not the only stuff that gets blocked. It's a little fuzzy on the map, but even some of the conservative political bloggers have been blocked. We looked at some of those. In one case, it was for using sort of ethnic slurs against Arabs. In another case, it was for supporting very, very fervently the idea of the temporary marriages. And then some of the poets get blocked, too. And we read some of those, and it's because there's quite a bit of love in that love poetry. Once we have these maps, we can also look at, well, how are different parts of the network talking about stuff? So in the Iranian network, we can say, well, which ones have used the word America in the last period of time? We see that immediately most of the religious bloggers drop out, but almost all of the conservative political bloggers stay. So we can understand both visually but also quantitatively, because these are also represented as numbers, what it is that folks are talking about. Democracy, a lot of the conservative politics bloggers stay in there. A lot of them, you might be surprised to know, actually talk a great deal about democratic values, but from a different perspective. You can also see other interesting stuff. So a lot of Islam is a major topic of conversation, as is Palestine, though somewhat less. But you can see how particular corners of the network will often talk about certain things. So in the lower left, you can see Evin Prison, the political prison in Tehran, where they put people that they don't like. The people that talk about it are largely the people that might end up there someday. The 12th Imam, the Mahdi, which I described before, is mostly talked about by that 12er group in the lower right. We can also look at, well, what websites do they link to? So where are they getting their news and information, for instance? So the major Iranian sources, Fars News and ISNA, get a lot of attention from the reformists and also from the conservative political bloggers. Ruse and BozTop, some online sources, you can see where they get their attention from. BozTop distinctly picks up more attention from the conservative side. And then where do they get their news from in an international context? And this is interesting because BBC Persian is probably the largest traditional legacy media organization that gets linked to by Iranian bloggers. Radio Farda, somewhat less. But look at Wikipedia and YouTube. These new players, and this is the Farsi language Wikipedia, are quoted across the map, and they have a larger footprint than any of the foreign services do. We thought that was very interesting. So now just a quick tour through some other countries, and I know we're running out of time, but here's the Arabic blogosphere. If we did some human coding to go and see where, asking our coders to look at where bloggers lived, and we sort of found that it's organized this way. You've got a big group around Saudi Arabia, the biggest group around Egyptian. Then you also find other groups. Kuwaiti is another group. I also know Iraq has a group on there, which you're not seeing. But so it's mostly organized around national groupings. But there are these sort of trading zones that mix bloggers from different countries, and we're doing some qualitative analysis of those right now. Russian blogosphere, if you just point the same tools at Russia, you get, first of all, something like this, which is incredibly confusing and very misleading. It looks like there are sort of five Russian blogospheres, and what you're seeing are the fact that the Russian online space is organized around a fundamentally different architecture. Blogs, which are the way most people are doing it, are blog roles and posts. There's sort of two paradigms there. One is who do you link to who is a permanent link on your page, and who are you linking to in your posts as they stream by. Russia is organized much more the way Facebook is organized, or MySpace, around friends lists and communities, groups, etc. And it leads to a much more difficult problem to analyze. Rather than get bogged down in that, I will simply point out that it is a different architecture, that it is dominated by a series of major players, and that, however, enable and organize a lot of very small niches, and how those come together into anything like the kind of global spanning communications you find in a lot of other countries is something we're very interested in. The Chinese blogosphere, and with different visualization engine put this out so the dots look a little different, is also very interestingly organized, largely here around different services. So blog services have more internal links, but not the way Russia is, not where almost all internal. Not if you're on LiveJournal, you pretty much only are linking to LiveJournal. You still are linking to other services, and we are looking at this map starting now. Important to understand that bloggers are not just the whole story. They are only one stratum in a networked information ecosystem. And a lot of what bloggers do in the U.S. is focus, and everywhere, is focus attention onto things that are not blogs. So only about 38-40% of links in the U.S. Blogosphere are to other blogs. The rest are to media, to NGOs, to other kinds of online entities, YouTube, etc. So blogosphere is kind of like a collective lens for channeling attention onto other things besides blogs, and you can map that out analytically. So we study the relationship between the blogosphere, its neighborhoods, and what it is they're focusing attention onto. And this is the danger of moving this to a PC, which means some of my images are probably going to die. So it's good. It cuts down some time. We saw before the image of who's linking to Evan Prison. So there's a lot of data behind this stuff. So on the right, you see a preference profile for a particular cluster of the blogosphere. And we can say, well, what is everything that they are linking to preferentially? And everything that is high up there on the y-axis going up north are things that everybody links to. That's YouTube, that's Wikipedia, et cetera. The things that end up distributed out to the right are the things that cluster of people are paying particular attention to. And so in this case, Evan Prison would be just one example of a dot out there. So that is what you see on the left represents a single dot on the right, and then what you see on the right represents a single column of something like this. So you can create a very detailed understanding of what the preferences are for linking across this map. And that's what that is. How much time do I have to have? Anything?
Two more minutes.
Two more minutes. Okay, let me wrap up. So I was asked to talk a little bit about what this sort of understanding might lead one to think in terms of action. And I think that there are some environmental goals, some how would one promote a healthy online public sphere, a few ideas. One, infrastructure. I mean, to create a network of people that are linking to information, the information has to be linkable. It has to be there. It has to have the right kinds of hooks, the right kinds of social media tools to make it sticky, easy to pick up and to link to. You also need the kind of infrastructure in terms of bloggers and meme trackers and search engines that enable that environment to thrive. But maybe more importantly, you need what I want to call oxygen. So you have to have the energy, the oxygen in this network to get people interested in doing it. So part of that is kind of a social capital thing. I mean, bloggers in the U.S. are motivated by all kinds of reasons. A lot of it is basically social capital. Some of it is money. But, you know, if I'm a high-profile blogger, I have a role in my community of fellow practitioners of whatever my practice is. If I'm a law blogger, if I'm an international politics blogger, I'm motivated by that network of relationships, both with the people around me, kind of my fellow knowledge workers, but also by the chance for maybe some publicity. Maybe what I have to say will get picked up in a more high-profile part of the food chain. Journalists might contact me for stories. I know that I'm very aware that I'm part of an information ecosystem where I've got some jazz. So you need that oxygen in terms of the social capital. I think, for instance, what Global Voices does on the international context is great, because if you go to one of the conferences, what you see is these folks are no longer isolated in their, they're now networked with a group of people that are with whom they can share knowledge and gain resources and gain support and just gain the community the motivation to take part in things. Oxygen also means that there has to be some kind of a porous border between the official media, the legacy media, and the network media ecosystem. So, you know, you have to have some chance of your intellectual activity gaining a wider audience. You don't have to, but that is another form of the oxygen. And then understanding is simply, you know, the kinds of intelligence you can get on the space by doing this sort of analysis to understand who's talking about what where. And in terms of taking action, I think that, you know, a lot of the way that this is applied is not in this global understanding mode. It's in, well, finding out who is talking about what. I mean, most of the folks that you would be likely to work with, I imagine, have their issues. They have the things that they care about. Well, those conversations are happening somewhere in these networks. And you don't have to worry about all the people blogging about football. You can find the people that are blogging or that show signs of being attentive to the thing you care about and map them specifically and go find them. Once you find them, you can understand the way they think of the issues, the context of their discussions, what are they paying attention to, how do they talk about things. We can mine language to understand the key words, the key terms that people are using in different parts of the network. So you want the people that you're working with to be able to understand the ecosystem around their issues. And this also helps them find allies, who are the people they ought to be networking with and reaching out to. And finding those allies helps build their capacity, and ultimately it helps them shift the debate in whatever the network is that they want to engage with around the issue that they care about.
Thanks, John. I have lots of questions, and I'm sure the audience, people in the audience do too, but we'll save those for after each of the panelists have spoken. So next up is Ethan Zuckerman, who is a well-known and well-loved face at OSI. He's the founder of GeekCore and the global blog aggregation site Global Voices Online. Ethan is a fellow at the Berkman Center and a prolific blogger as well at My Heart's My Heart's in Accra. Over to you.
Thanks, Darius. I'm a very visual guy. It's very strange for me to sit in front of one of these panels and not show slides, but I presented with John before and I learned my lesson. And I know that there's nothing that I'm going to show you that's nearly as pretty as John shows, so I'm just going to wave my hands and talk, which is not my usual MO. I'm also going to play the role here of anecdote guy, because John's work is really sort of about putting together really large sets of data and making sort of general conclusions from it. I'm going to take really tiny sets of data and make equally broad, sweeping conclusions about it with a lot less methodological rigor. This is a real academic, this is a para-academic, and this is how this stuff works out. But in reacting to what John put forward, I want to react to a couple of things in turn and maybe broaden this idea of what happens in constrained and sometimes repressive blogospheres. Let me first say that I think one of the things that you may be seeing in the Iranian models are a function of when in time this analysis has been done. So one of the things that we saw at Global Voices that's been pretty fascinating is a shift from what we characterized as bridge blogging activity to sort of native blogging activity. So if we sort of roll back time to, say, 2003, 2004, it wasn't all that uncommon to find people, for instance, in the Arabic blogosphere, blogging primarily in English. And this had a lot to do with the fact that there just wasn't that much of an Arabic-speaking audience online at that point. If you wanted to talk to somebody, you were going to talk in a language that people spoke. And I remember hanging out with Jordanian bloggers and essentially saying, well, wait, you guys are all much more comfortable in Arabic. Why aren't you writing in Arabic? And they would sort of look around and say, well, these are the Arabic speakers. You know, we'd like to reach someone else beyond that. What's interesting is the level of net penetration in Iran and sort of how quickly it came on. So my guess is one of the reasons that we sort of over-focus on these liberal reformist bloggers isn't just that we desperately want there to be a reformist movement in Iran and we want these folks to be blogging, but it's actually sort of who was first to the game, who we started paying attention to. Our experience around Global Voices is that this bridging state may actually just be a phase. It may be what happens when there isn't much of a local blogosphere. Once you can start writing and talking to a local audience, you are less compelled to sort of reach out internationally and speak to an international audience. It doesn't disappear entirely, but that motivation changes and shifts a little bit. And it seems like it's actually much easier to address the local audience than it is to address the global audience. So one thing to think about might be time series on this stuff. I wanted to talk a little bit about significantly less rich and less defined blogospheres. Because one of these things, and this is sort of an American tendency, we sort of look at the Iranian blogosphere and say, well, that must be tremendously repressive. And in terms of how many individual blogs are blocked, that's true. It's one of the more highly censored, more highly filtered environments. But I want to talk briefly about how Ethiopia eliminated blogging, all of it. Ethiopia in 2004, 2005 had an incredibly lively blogosphere. This has a lot to do with Ethiopian political culture, where there are arguments that have been going on since the 1950s. My friends who study Ethiopia seriously tell me that there are debates that sort of started during these wonderful meetings in Paris about sort of post-colonial Africa, where everybody else would go out drinking together and the Ethiopians would stay at a table yelling at each other, and now their grandchildren are having exactly the same arguments but sort of continuing to find ways to yell at one another. So you have these highly polarized positions. The tendency in the Ethiopian blogosphere is you put up an assertion and it's responded to with pages and pages of commentary. So people who've sort of stumbled into this find themselves, you know, getting entire essays in response to a single link that they've put up. So in 04 and 05, we were all sort of looking at this and saying, well, this is fascinating. This is going to be the most politically rich, the most rigorous African blogosphere. We're all enjoying watching this. And then it died. And it died almost immediately. And what happened was, in the wake of nonviolent demonstrations, which were broken up with live gunfire in 2005, Ethiopia first blocked SMS messaging, because that's what mobilized people out into the streets. And they actually turned off SMS for a little more than 2 years. A government that turns off SMS is sort of on a very, very high repression scale. This is a tool that 99.7% of the time is not being used to overthrow a government. It's a very practical thing. And if you're willing to turn it off, you're basically at a very, very high level of paranoia about your political space organizing itself. But Ethiopians then went a little bit further and had ETC, the wonderful Ethiopia Telecommunications Corporation, block not just the individual high-profile blogs of people, but blogger.com, which at that point was the most popular blogging platform. Now, there was a small enough population in Ethiopia that was blogging that groups like Global Voices were able to reach out to those individual bloggers and say, hey, we can help you continue to post. Here's how you use a proxy server. Here's how you continue to maintain it. What we were not able to do was figure out how to get proxy servers and such out to the audience. So what you ended up with was a couple of bloggers who continued posting, but they were only being read by the diaspora. They weren't being read by anyone in Ethiopia anymore. The comments fell off. The notion that they were actually engaged with the dialogue fell off. Then you had a heavy dose of personal intimidation. One of the best bloggers in the country in 2005 was an Italian woman. She was actually the wife of a diplomat who blogged as Addis Ferengi. And she was detained, threatened, told that her husband would be kicked out of the country if she continued blogging. She ceased blogging, started blogging again once she was back in Italy. But that was sort of the death knell. So we reached this point about sort of 6 months after the sort of peak of the space where suddenly every interesting Ethiopian blog was blocked, and killing off that audience was essentially shutting off the oxygen that John is talking about. It turns out that if no one is reading your blog, you will stop blogging. None of us are so tone deaf that if no one is listening to us after 3 months, we're not going to stop doing this. And particularly in the political blogosphere, that's a big one. Let me talk really briefly about a couple of other spaces that I think are just sort of interesting to think about in contrast. Zimbabwe, so I'm an Africanist, so a lot of these are going to be Africa examples. Zimbabwe has a surprising, thriving blogosphere, which is extremely prominently anti-government. And one of the problems we have with Global Voices is that we try pretty hard to give you a balanced view of what bloggers are saying in a country. The trick in Zimbabwe is that there's one ZANU-PF blogger. He's a really sweet guy. He's a dear old friend of mine. His name is Dumisani Nyoni, but there's one of him. And everybody else is an MDC blogger. For the most part, they're significantly wealthier. For the most part, they're white. They're from a very different socioeconomic strata than the average Zimbabweans. If you look at Zimbabwe through blogs, you're going to end up with this impression that people would like to throw Mugabe out tomorrow. And actually, the picture is far, far more complicated than that. Even in, you know, MDC's version of the election, it's unlikely that MDC got more than 55% of the votes. There's still a large rural population that supports the old man. What's interesting is that when you come at this from the blog space, you would miss it entirely because of who's blogging. What's interesting about this is that Zimbabwe probably has the ability to constrain access to a lot of online speech. They have highly centralized ISPs. They have a very well-developed state security apparatus. They've threatened, they banned my blog, for instance, Global Voices, within Zimbabwe, but it's not blocked. The last time that I was in Zimbabwe, I was able to access all of these sites. We continue to monitor through OpenNet initiative, and none of these highly controversial, highly critical blogs are blocked. We think the reason for this is that these blogs have basically zero political influence. They're reaching the 5% of people who have enough money that they're capable of, you know, already doing things like subscribing to the Mail and Guardian in South Africa, which is significantly more critical than any of these blogs are going to be. But someone who is sort of high enough that they're able to access the internet on a regular basis, read the blogs, keep up with the news that way, is already so far from ZANU-PF's power base that it's almost not worth going after them at that point. Let me mention two more things sort of in passing. I'm really looking forward to John's work on the Chinese blogosphere because almost everything we know about the rest of the world sort of breaks down once we move into China. One of the biggest things that breaks down is how censorship works. Generally speaking, we expect censorship to sort of work within a blogosphere. You look at what blogs and what news sources are in place, and you block either individual, potentially controversial sites. So you go to all of blogspot.com and you say, these 10 blogs are really highly critical, we're going to block them. Or you get much, much more aggressive and you say, we're going to block blogger.com. We're simply not going to let you access this entire service. There's a high social cost in blocking blogger.com or blocking youtube.com. If you're interested in this, Google the cute cat theory. This is a talk that I've been giving for the last year or so. And it basically says that one of the reasons it's so hard for Pakistan to show up and block YouTube is that 97% of people going to YouTube aren't looking for political information. They're looking for that video of the cat flushing the toilet. And when you block YouTube.com, everyone who went to look at the cute cat video suddenly goes, wait a second, I'm living in a repressive state. What are they blocking me from seeing? So you actually sort of raise the interest in this. China does this really differently and really, really well. China basically blocks all social media tools that we know, but there are Chinese equivalents of all these social media tools. So you wouldn't really want to go to Flickr anyway because it's in an English language interface. Here's something with a really nice Chinese language interface. You'd rather use that tool. Unfortunately, that tool has censorship baked into it. And by baked in, we mean you go to Microsoft's blogging service in China, MSN Spaces, and you enter in a blog title of, I love freedom, human rights, and democracy, and you get back the message in Chinese saying, your blog title may not contain obscenity or other prohibited language. Please choose another blog title. Rebecca McKinnon, my research partner, has a wonderful set of papers on this. So what we're seeing in China is actually a move back from sort of Web 2.0 technologies like blogging back into Web 1.0. Or at least this is the theory that Michael Anti, who's a very prominent Chinese dissident, puts forward. He basically says, because these things are so centralized, because they're so controlled, because they're so easy to monitor, they don't make sense as loci for democratic speech. We're going to see people going back to bulletin board systems. We're going to see people using chat lines. We're going to see people using much less centralized and, frankly, much less effective technologies for disseminating this. But because it's less centralized, it's not as easy to censor. Say one thing in closing, and this isn't about a repressive nation. This is about why blogging matters and why actually it's sort of very encouraging to see the level of civic discourse in a place like Iran. Folks who follow Kenya know that Kenya had an extremely tumultuous political period starting basically on Boxing Day of last year and sort of going through February. Kenya is a remarkably open sub-Saharan African society, very high degree of press freedom, actually high degree of press function. And what was really interesting was to watch what happened as you had an intergovernmental struggle between a government that I think probably could be legitimately described as seizing and holding power over an opposition. While the government did seize and hold power, it didn't shut down SMS. Instead, it responded by sending out a message essentially saying, you know, please be careful about going out in the streets and don't hurt anyone, which was still viewed as sort of very controversial speech. There was a broadcast ban for about 2 days where broadcast television, radio, print were not producing real-time news. But the bloggers were. And what was very interesting about this was that Kenya now has probably the most robust, best integrated African blogosphere. There's 2,000-3,000 bloggers. There's good networks. There's an award system. Awards turn out to be really important in the blogosphere. When you've got a group that can sort of give each other awards, it actually shows a high degree of function. What happened was bloggers who are not political suddenly became incredibly political. So you had a blogger like Bankalele. And you read Bankalele if you're trading in the Kenyan stock market. This guy is an insider at a Kenyan investment bank. He's an amazing way of sort of tracking whether or not you should be buying or selling Kenya Airways. He suddenly shifted over to being this incredible high-level political analyst. A guy named Dawdy Were, Mental Acrobatics, is a tech blogger. He's just a geek. But he jumped out into the streets with his camera and started getting into the face of demonstrations and doing sort of amazing original photojournalism. So what I love about this Kenyan story is that blogging the vast majority of time is pretty banal. Most of the time, you just don't care. But what's really interesting is that when you hit a crisis situation, Kenya seems to demonstrate that in a robust blogosphere where people are paying attention to one another, there's the possibility that this online media can rapidly become a highly political alternative and sometimes dissident media. So I think that's something to consider in all of these maps that you're looking at with John, where you're looking at this and saying, well, isn't this really odd? You know, 9/10 of this picture isn't anything that I would care about. that other 9/10, if it's well interconnected, if it's high functioning, may actually be sort of a media network waiting to happen if it needs to come into play. So why don't I stop there?
Thanks, Ethan. Our next panelist is Parochista Khakpour. Parochista was born in Iran but raised in the U.S. and now lives here in New York City. She's a journalist whose work has appeared in the New York Times, The Village Voice, and Bedouin and other publications. And she's also a novelist who's just published a year ago, I believe, Suns and Other Flammable Objects.
Thank you. Okay, so if Ethan is going to give a tiny disclaimer after John, I have to give a less tiny one after John and Ethan. I am a fiction writer and not a media authority of any sort, so I think I have to say that. So I'm going to talk from a very personal perspective and maybe at times a little bubblegum perspective too, so forgive me. I'll give a few stories and talk about my connection with the Iranian blogosphere as an Iranian American, a former blogger. And someone who's in touch with a lot of Iranian bloggers in Iran and outside of Iran. One thing I've done in the last, since my novel's come out, is that last year I created the Goodreads group, Literature of Iran and the Diaspora. And as of last night, we had about 150 members and 106 books listed, which is really not much, actually, compared to some of the other Iranian groups. The Rumi group actually has 917 people. It's pretty incredible. I am the moderator, but I really don't do much. It's kind of taken off without me. If you don't know what Goodreads is, just a few words about that. It's a networking and social cataloging website for book lovers that started about 2 years ago in Santa Monica, California. And users create reading lists, personal libraries, and book groups. And last January in the LA Times, they reported that 1/5 of Goodreads users were Iranian, which was kind of incredible to me, and that's why I started my group. I wanted to figure out who the Iranians were that were on the site. It was definitely, at that point, off the Iranian government's radar because it was relatively small, and it was about books and not politics, so, you know, why block it? Eventually, it did get blocked by certain service providers, it seems, but like Ethan spoke to, proxy servers made it very easy to get around that. So that's kind of what I'm doing currently. A little bit about me and the web as an Iranian American. I am of that group that came to the U.S. At the advent of the Iran-Iraq war. I was here in the U.S. when I was 3, but born in Tehran. And I still remember when my dad, who was a sort of technologically unsavvy scientist, got us our first computer in 1994, which felt pretty late, actually. And I still remember getting obsessed with Prodigy and its crappy web browsers and America Online and all that. And I immediately became a huge internet geek, mostly because I was still I had a very traditional Iranian family. I wasn't allowed to sleep over at people's houses. I wasn't allowed to go to school dances or anything. So I became obsessed with chat rooms. They really shaped me, you know, not mostly very nerdy chat rooms, you know, nothing, you know, salacious in any way, but it really shaped me in a big way and started my internet addiction. Eventually, college and grad school were off periods from internet use, but eventually in 2003, I kept getting invites to a social network service called Friendster. I kept getting invites over and over, and I hated the name. I found it so unappealing. Friendster is icky. And finally, I joined it, and it was huge for me. It was the first time I'd ever been on a site like that, and I'd rediscovered all these old friends, you know, even found a boyfriend via it, you know. And by 2004, I actually ended up moving to Chicago to be a staff writer at the Chicago Reader, and it was a work-from-home job. So my internet addiction got worse and worse because I was pretending to work part of the time, but the rest of the time I was online. And eventually friends of mine sort of peer pressured me into Live Journal, and I started a Live Journal, which was my first stint at blogging in 2004. It felt really infantile. I was in my mid-20s at that point, but everyone on it seemed to be in their 20s and 30s and 40s. You know, it didn't seem that weird. And so I became a Live Journal blogger under an alias, mostly because I was still worried my parents would discover the real me. I made lots of friends, some virtual and real, some who still know me by that alias, which is strange. And then I stopped that in 2005 when I moved to a community that didn't recognize live journal as much. That was Los Angeles for some reason. That also interests me, different places in even this country where different things are popular at different times. It wasn't in Los Angeles. In the summer of 2007, right before my debut novel came out, I decided to start a blog again, but admittedly, because I was too cheap to get an author website, my publishers wouldn't pay for, a fancy author website. So, and at that point, I had really plowed through my advance, so I got a blog spot. And it was a little embarrassing. It lasted for a year because I was only using it for promotional purposes, really. I mean, telling people about things like this, come see me here, or I did this article there, and I wasn't blogging properly. So I shut it down after a year, and I'm considering blogging again. I do it sporadically right now at redroom.com, which is an online home for authors. Of course, I'm glued to Facebook with my 687 friends and their constant status updates, and I constantly consider Twitter. I'm always on the verge. And this winter, I'm actually, for a publication, going to check myself into an internet addiction rehab. I'm not joking, actually, an inpatient facility, because the 4 to 8 hours at least I spend on top of a full-time job are just getting a little out of hand. Part of it has been being obsessed with Iranian blogs. There's several blogs I look at constantly. One is the very popular Iranian.com. It's an online English language magazine founded in the mid-90s by Jahan Jojavid. And it's got, I think, the largest online following among Iranians residing in North America. My stats might be a little bit old, but I believe it's still around 660,000 unique visitors and nearly 6 million page views per month. So it's fairly huge. And it's recently gone Web 2.0. Right now, people are having their own blogs on it. They're uploading all sorts of unique content without much monitoring and certainly no censorship within Iran and outside of Iran. Another blog I look at is called Life Goes On in Tehran. It's a personal monthly photo blog by a former Los Angeles resident who's now moved to Tehran, an Iranian-American who's now identifying really as an Iranian only. And he's featuring photos taken by a camera phone almost exclusively. It's a wonderful sight if you haven't seen it. His mission is to show that regardless of what any president would have you imagine, despite what any media outlet would have you believe, life goes on in Tehran and elsewhere in Iran. And it's never overtly a political a site, although once in a while he sneaks in things. I also look at Pars Arts, an independent English language site highlighting Iranian life abroad. It's an Iranian-American site that's fixated primarily on entertainment and arts. Another one I'm interested in is ddmmyyyyy.org. I can never remember this guy's site. It's David Yaroubi's site. He's a 30-something, again, an Iranian Brit who has now moved back to Iran. There's a whole group of these people who are very active bloggers. He's now identifying again primarily as an Iranian, and he has this wonderfully engaging blog where he talks about his life in Tehran. And there's various other news sites that are off many people's radar. I mean, I look at Noctiz, which is all about entertainment and the arts, not political at all. And it's even gone further. There's another site called mashroobandmustaches.blogspot.com, which is very funny and Farsi, the mashroob part means beer, so it's beer and mustaches. And this is like not only not fixated on Iranian politics, it's not even fixated on Iranian entertainment. It's just a total hipster blog with once in a while they'll reveal that they're sort of Iranian. And they're just, it has obviously a lot, I think, to do with assimilation with this group of Iranians, Iranian Americans who've been born in not just the 80s, but now the 90s, and of course, I look at various social justice blogs. I'm particularly interested in the many against the child executions and the juvenile death rows in Iran. And of course, recently, one's about Eshaw Momeni, the Iranian-American activist who was arrested in Iran in mid-October. I just asked a couple of these Iranian bloggers just for their thoughts about this, because I told them I'm going to be talking here, and I just wanted to just hear what they had to say about some of the issues that we were going to bring up today. And David Yarubi of DDMM, why? He's going to hate me when he sees that I butchered this, but sorry, David. He says that he thinks blogs died a while ago, and now it's all about Web 2.0. He especially points to Yahoo 360, which I think is not so popular here. I mean, I feel like I'd be addicted to it if it was, but it's you know, he's completely obsessed with Yahoo 360. He says Orkut, Facebook, Flickr, Goodreads, this is the new revolution, and it should be titled the Proxy Evolution, which I love. He says there is really still no problem setting up the proxy servers and getting around all the blocking. I have to reject the name of the Life Goes On in Tehran guy. Let's call him A. He also talks about the Iranian character, the pride of Iranians, and Iranians always loving to talk about themselves and their culture and always trying to break stereotypes and loving to present themselves. And he says that's kind of kept the blogosphere fueled and going. Actually, A says that he started the photo blog, Life Goes On in Tehran, mostly for the West's benefit. He wanted his Western friends to see what life in Iran was really like, and he's very proud of the weekly emails he gets from people that write and say, "Oh, I had no idea this was what, you know, Iran was like." And A also talks about what David talked about too, about how all these, especially the social networking sites, are there because there's no place for young people to hang out. There is no public nightlife. They both say this. In my imagination, I thought that, but I kept thinking there must be something we don't know about. And they say it over and over. These are, you know, young, active folks with lots of friends. So they say Yahoo 360 becomes like a cyber bar. And in that way, I think of Goodreads as a cyber coffee house, I guess, in some ways. And, you know, Life Goes On in Tehran, the camera phone's been wonderful for him because he can sneak into house parties and take photos discreetly. So we can see what that nightlife, the private nightlife, is like. On the flip side, A also writes about the incidental benefit of the diaspora, who also write to him often and thank him for linking their past with this present Iran that they don't know. So it's had that function, too, that I think is interesting. Basically, in closing, I just to address why Iranians love the internet so much, you know, my theories based on a few facts and figures. I think this has been written about a lot, but we have to remember that modern technology was early on embraced by Iranians as a tool of social change. I mean, the 79 revolution, cassette tapes and fax machines played a huge part. If you remember, Khomeini was in France in exile, and people were getting a lot of his speeches and rhetoric through these tapes. So Iranians have always been hip to modern tech. And of course, there was this major crackdown on print media during Khatami's second term, around 2000, 2001. More than 57 newspapers were shut down, leaving 1,500 press workers unemployed, at least. So what do? They go to electronic media, of course. And then, of course, you have to remember Iran has an interesting demographic. 40% of Iran's population is between 15 to 35. That's the figure they throw around a lot. So that this whole cybersphere has been embraced by the youth, which is a considerable part of the population. I'm always amazed at figures I get about Iran having the highest percentage of internet users in the entire Middle East, and then second is Israel. I think it's incredible. And when the first blogs came out in late 2001, it was only 2 years later that Iran became the fastest growing cyberspace in the Middle East. Iran is ninth in the world for the number of blogs, but it's still, you know, on the list of the 15 enemies of the internet. So I that's always interesting to me, too. Also, in 2004, when some further crackdowns and restrictions were happening, a poll by an Iranian blogger revealed that Iranians trust the web more than radio, TV, satellite channels, press, and foreign-based radio, even though in 2004 only 5 to 10% of Iranians were active in cyberspace. That's pretty extraordinary that they have this trust in this idea even. And I often hear from relatives, too, about how Iran is filled with graffiti of URLs, which is nerdiest graffiti ever. So obviously, I referred to 2003-2004 and the government cracking down hugely then. But remember that it was just shortly after that the mullahs themselves started setting up their blogs. And of course, Ahmadinejad right now is probably the most popular Iranian blogger of all time, right, after he set up his blog in 2006. It all kind of makes sense to me in closing when I think of the Iranian character, too. I think Iranians love the anonymity of the web.
Evgeny.
Well, hi, everyone. What I'll try to do in my concluding talk is try to do the impossible and try to tie all of this three previous talk together and in a policy framework. So I think by now, by 2008, we have more or less all agreed that the web could be a powerful force, right? There is still a lot of disagreement whether it is a force for good, a force for much more dangerous forces, which we see in many of these authoritarian countries, right? And I think the battle we would see over the next 4 or 5 years on the web would operate from the assumption that, you know, the web is here to stay. I think the anecdote of Ethiopia that Ethan mentioned, it's a good anecdote, but I think we'll be seeing less and less of that and more of countries and governments accepting the web as a given and trying to figure out a way in which they can actually make it work for them without necessarily censoring it or without necessarily taking some actions which would disrupt these networks. Right? So I think it is a given, and we have to operate based on that assumption first. Right? I think the question then for a lot of policy organizations is, given that the web is there to stay, I mean, what could we do, right? And here I think research like John Kelly's is very helpful because, you know, it helps us to understand and visualize how these networks work and how information can propagate and flow between those networks, right? The danger here is that since networks usually are, you know, more or less neutral, all sorts of other information can flow through the networks, right? So by focusing on building the infrastructure, right, and getting people online, there is always this inherent danger that, you know, the bad guys would be taking advantage of the very same infrastructure to spread their own messages, right? And there is as much danger that it would be the governments who already accepted that the web is here to stay, who would be finding ways in which to manipulate public discussion online, right? And we have seen a few examples of that happening. The practice of astroturfing that, you know, exists here in the U.S., where a lot of companies are trying to present, you know, public discourse, supposedly public discourse, as something which, you know, is natural rather than created by PR companies. We see more and more of that happening on the web, where there is this famous case in China of the so-called 50 cent party, you know, of people who are supposedly being paid 50 cents per hour to comment on various forums and blogs and leave messages which are supportive of the government, which are supportive of the government ideology, right? And there is also evidence that there may be similar units operating in Russia who are affiliated with the government, whether it's direct affiliation or whether it is indirect cooperation. But there are entities and units which are eager to support and push for the government ideology online, right? So we have to be very well aware of the fact that all those networks we may be investing in and all those networks which we want to create could be potentially misused like any others. And the governments would be the first one who, have the resources and have the knowledge often to go and start openly exploiting them, right? So this is one thing. Another thing which I think we have to be cognizant of is that a lot of platforms exist, right? It's not just blogs. And as, you know, Parachista mentioned, you know, in Iran, it may be a site like Goodreads, right, which bloggers would discover and try to hide from authorities without being blocked, right? And that reflects a much broader trend that the most interesting content and the most sensitive content that organizations like OSI or others would want to look at, it would usually be hidden from public view. Because if you are working on human rights issues, or if you are working on social justice issues in these countries, and if you are blogging, the first precaution you would normally take often would be to say, I want to be, you know, in a closed garden rather than in a walled garden, rather than openly in the public, because that would get me in trouble. So in Russia, for example, the reason why LiveJournal took off is that it really helps you to separate who your friends are from the general public. So your blog and your community can be read only by people whom you approve of, you know, to whom you authorize to read it. And this is slightly different from the way standalone blogs like WordPress or Typepad operate here in the US and sort of in English language blogs. And I think you have to understand is that a lot of analysis, for example, which people like John have been doing, it looks at a lot of things which are public and which are available and which can be crawled and which can be analyzed. But, you know, people who we are most interested in, they're actually always three or four steps ahead of us because they want to be, they want to remain secretive and they don't want to be public. And this applies equally to the bad guys, you know, people who are, you know, Al-Qaeda and the rest, you know, they are using the secure forums. Many of them are not using public operations, right? So analysis would always lag behind, and that would, there would always be delay, and there would always be gaps in that, right? But the general question, I think, is a good one. How do you build a robust blogosphere, right? And I think Ethan made a very good point about Kenya, saying that, you know, the more about the blogosphere, the more chances we have that whatever conflicts happen, even if the mainstream media goes black, they will still be covered by the bloggers. And, you know, and here we've had this exchange with Ethan on, you know, the war in South Ossetia and how it has been, in my view, misreported or underreported by citizen journalists and new media, in part because there was no infrastructure and there was no robust networks of bloggers in Georgia or South Ossetia. And on top of that, there was no often electricity or, you know, internet infrastructure to start with, right? So the question here, I think, is a good one. How do you create, if you really want to amplify the voices of the reasonable people in South Ossetia or in Georgia, how do we build networks which would allow to amplify already existing voices? And I think that's a question where John research can help us, but it's still a very difficult and essentially a very complex question. You know, we had a meeting in Georgia, in Tbilisi, inviting, with Darius present there, you know, inviting people from Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan to give country presentations of what's happening in, you know, their own national blogospheres. And our understanding was that, for example, Armenia and Azerbaijan, and that was around mid-June, so it was before the war. So Armenia and Azerbaijan were very, well, more or less well-developed blogospheres. They had social networks, diaspora played a huge role, there were a lot of a lot of Azeri bloggers are present on Iranian platforms, a lot of Azeri bloggers are present on Turkish networks, a lot of them are present on Russian networks. The Armenian diaspora is helping the Armenian blogosphere. With Georgia, it seemed like there was very little interaction either with the diaspora or with Russian bloggers because of the language issue or with anyone else outside of Georgia. And the blogosphere itself seemed very underdeveloped. From my perspective, for example. But then the question is, what are the concrete steps that we could do to make this network bigger or to make sure that journalists finally start to blog, or that public intellectuals in Georgia start to blog, or, you know, that blogging suddenly goes mainstream? There are many factors here, and I think the word ecosystem here is the correct one, because, you know, unless, for example, journalists see a direct incentive in blogging, they would never start blogging. And before journalists join, others wouldn't. Because, you know, there have to be payoffs, and these payoffs have to be obvious and visible. If your blog is read by five people, and if there are only seven bloggers in the country, chances are, if you can write a newspaper article, and if you can write an NGO report, you will still write an NGO report rather than, you know, post to a blog, because it's just not visible and it's not read. Then the question is, how do we create better institutions or platforms for this content to be discovered? And, you know, regarding the question of censorship, I think it is an important question, but we also have to realize that very often, and particularly more often, now we see much more sophisticated and subtle means of discouraging people from blogging. And I'll give you a very interesting example from LiveJournal and from Russia and Georgia specifically. The most credible voice who was providing very insightful comment on the war in South Ossetia was a Georgian blogger who was a refugee from Abkhazia in the first war in the 90s, who was blogging on LiveJournal, very critical of what Moscow was doing, also very critical of what Saakashvili was doing, but more or less a guy with a very interesting and insightful perspective, who was commenting on a lot of local events with a very interesting analysis. He was widely read by Russian bloggers and by Russian media because he was doing all of that in Russian. So that was one of the few voices that were doing this. What happened is that about a month ago, there was suddenly a flurry of cyber attacks against his blog. Somebody basically hired, you can actually go and hire now this denial of service attackers. So you can go and pay a very minimal sum of money, hire an attacker, hire whatever, a botnet, a network of computers, and then they launched an attack which was so powerful that the administrators of LiveJournal had nothing else to do but to remove his account for LiveJournal to continue operating. Right, the attack was so powerful that people who administer probably a million blogs had no other way to make sure that the site, the whole site, all million blogs stay online, other than to ask him to leave the platform and take all of his content with him. Right, so the guy moved to WordPress.com, another blogging platform, where he was also subject of attacks, and he was also silenced down because administrators found nothing that they could do to keep the entire platform online, right? So that's basically, would it show up on any of the OpenNet initiative maps? I don't know. You know, it was a very short, LiveJournal is unavailable for 1 hour, right? It may not show up. But the bottom line is that, a very critical and interesting voice has been silenced basically through almost extortion and blackmailing the administrators, telling them, either remove him or, we'll continue attacking, right? Who stands behind these attacks? It's very hard to know because most of them are anonymous. Whether it is nationalists, and we've seen it a lot during the cyber dimension to the war in South Ossetia, whether it's nationalists who are cooperating online, relying on the same very tools, blogs and forums, to target such critical voices and to target such dissenting voices. We don't know, but we see more and more evidence of this happening. So I think we are looking in the right direction by trying to visualize and map all of that. We just have to be sure that we not only rely on anecdotal evidence, but we also actively reach out and see what are some of the ways in which people are being asked to, keep silent or are being, censored. Whether it's soft censorship or whether it's hard censorship, it's a difficult question. But my concern is that we see the governments, instead of just solely relying on censorship as they did in the past, actually trying to find very interesting, subtle, and sophisticated strategies which take advantage of the internet to solidify the already existent authoritarian regimes. And I think that's the biggest battle we'll see in the next 5-10 years. It will be whether, the activists eventually manage to turn the internet into something more than just a tool for mobilizing people, or whether the governments will actually turn this tool into a platform of pacifying people, suppressing dissent, and maybe people keeping people happy being in cyber bars or cyber cafes or elsewhere, right? I mean, I think it's an important question, something I call cyber hedonism, whether the internet would make people, suddenly happier online and, would sort of force them almost to forget, the problems of the real world. It may seem like a very science fiction question, but we see more and more of that happening, in Russia and China and elsewhere. And if we actually go and start applying anthropological frameworks to looking, what do the young people do online? Do they suddenly get all engaged? Only the 1% who do get reported in the Western media get engaged, but 99% friend who don't yet engage and sit at home and watch TV and watch whatever YouTube videos, you know, are they getting more active? Are they getting more passive? Does it make them more likely to go out and suddenly revolt? Or it actually sort of contributes to pacifying them a little bit? So I think those are some of the questions we have to explore and add to some of the questions which John is asking, which I think are fundamentally very good questions. But I think a lot of the things are so intangible, or they differ platform by platform and country by country, that, you know, building a bigger model may actually, you know, mislead us into thinking that we understand it well. Well, in fact, we don't. So I'll stop here.
Thanks, Evgeny. We're running a bit behind schedule, but we do have time for questions. So I'd like to open up for questions from the floor. And I'd ask you to use a mic. Do we have maybe we can pass this around? And introduce yourselves as well.
Hi, my name is Gabriel Hopkins. I'm working with a small NGO called Digital Democracy. I have a question for the whole panel. Thank you very much, everybody, for speaking. It was very, very interesting. But one question I have about this issue of opening blogospheres and other networks in authoritarian regimes is sort of for us in non-authoritarian countries or non-authoritarian regimes, if you will, do we have a responsibility or should we be supporting people in places that are restrictive in various ways to open up their networks? Is this something that we should allow to sort of happen naturally? Or are there concrete steps that people here can make to liberalize their networks or open things up, make things easier for them to blog? Sort of my question.
Thank you. Who'd like to take that first? John? Or Ethan?
Look, I think there is understandable and well-placed enthusiasm for support for free speech movements all over the world from people who are trying to use new media in this country and in more open societies. I think that it's well placed. I also think that it's really important that we be realistic. And I get fairly unpopular with some of my colleagues, particularly folks within Open Net Initiative, when I suggest that it's unlikely that the United Arab Emirates is ever going to stop blocking Playboy.com. And, you know, if you're running a conservative Islamic government, there's probably certain types of content that you are going to block. And I think it probably makes a certain amount of sense to distinguish between some of the social filtering based on what local legislation and regulations are and political filtering. One of the reasons that groups like Open Net Initiative get so worried about filtering is that filtering tends to be a slippery slope. Everybody starts out and says, yes, we're a conservative Islamic state, we're going to block porn, but then you've got the apparatus in place and then you start blocking political speech when that speech gets uncomfortable. Over at Global Voices, we've sort of had to make a decision. Do we get active in supporting every single blogger who gets blocked, every sort of instance of speech getting blocked? We've decided to get very active on the blocking of platforms for speech. So we get really worried when someone decides to block a whole tool, like Blogger or Flickr or something along those lines, because we're worried about constraining generativity. We're worried about losing that ability to generate and create new speech that could be very political. As far as the question, which I read to be sort of what can we do about it, how can we be engaged with it, I think the case that I'm trying to make is sort of standing up and assuming that the U.S. First Amendment applies anywhere other than the U.S. is probably a poor idea and generally makes people who take that stance look like idiots, not accusing you of doing that, but that's frequently where these arguments come from. What I think is probably more helpful is to have sort of a slightly more nuanced understanding of this, understand that what we do want to get very insistent about is that you don't want people blocking political speech. Even in countries that are religiously or socially conservative. And I think we need to have sort of a concerted effort to ensure that platforms of freedom of expression do remain open for political speech. And what's interesting is that I think we're seeing traditional speech defenders, press freedom defenders, human rights organizations realizing that this is the locus for these discussions, probably for the next decade or so. It's been surprising how long it's taken
for a lot of the traditional journalism organizations in particular to sort of get over the bloggers are evil, they're going to kill our business, to sort of realizing that if you're going to defend journalists late in this decade, you're going to be defending them in an online space.
Evgeny?
I agree with what Ethan said. I think a lot of also Western activism will focus on, targeting Western companies which are complicit with, the Chinese government or any other governments that, you know, they would make a deal with them like Yahoo did. You know, there is a lot of debate, you know, to what extent, you know, Google is complicit. And I think it is more or less still within the realm of Western activists to force their own companies to behave well in those countries. I think the second dimension to this, which is still unexplored and which I think will become crucial in the next few years, is pressing and forcing and pressuring Western internet service providers and hosting companies specifically who are hosting a lot of these oppositional sites from, you know, Southeast Asia or the Middle East or, you know, the Caucasus, who do find themselves under pressure, mostly which has to do with, you know, cyber warfare and cyber attacks to delete those sites. You know, and we've seen that in the case of Burma, we've seen that in the case of Mauritania recently, we see it more and more with Russian-based activist organizations. You know, a lot of Western hosting companies would rather not have the pain of hosting a site belonging to the Burmese opposition, because they would find themselves under tremendous pressure. They would be attacked, they would have to deal with cyber warfare, many other things. And, you know, and I think more or less, it's still not a big problem, but it's getting bigger and bigger almost every week and every month. And I think in 2 or 3 months, there would be, you know, there should be some sort of a, you know, conference or some sort of a talk, and there should be some sort of a document which would outline the best practices in this field, because otherwise, you know, there would just be no place to host those sites critical of the regime and critical of the opposition. And I think there is a lot for Western activists to do in this space by pressuring, you know, hosting companies. Or we should just forget that model altogether and then just build a non-profit model for hosting such sites. But again, it has to be explored, and there has to be some, you know, involvement from the governments and policy institutions.
Thanks, Evgeny. Any comments from John or Protocisto?
I'm just going to say two words just to piggyback a little bit more on what Ethan was saying just briefly. Just an obvious point is that we obviously have to constantly remember that the will of the people are very different than the will of the government always, particularly in the case of Iran, most obviously. But also an interesting anecdote that I remember that happened with Goodreads in particular was that they were getting a lot of profiles being, this intern at Goodreads was getting all these profiles being flagged as inappropriate. From, you know, and they were all Iranian names, and he would go through them and he would notice they were just Iranian women who didn't have the headscarves in their photos. All these Iranian men were flagging them one after another as inappropriate. And Goodreads, in the end, decided not to take any action. You know, what are they going to do? Write to those women and say, put on some headscarves if you want to be part of Goodreads, you know? They didn't do anything, thank God, you know? But they constantly get that, and so that is, I think that speaks a little bit to what Ethan says about being a little bit nuanced and understanding, particularly when religion is involved, things become sticky in a tangled web, in a way.
John?
Is this on? Okay. I guess I'd just say, use this as a chance to point to something that I think has come out of what everyone said, which is that we do have to understand the difference between public networks of publicly visible discourse, which are potentially available to anyone in the society to read and are kind of more in a class with things like newspapers, and private discourse within social networks, within chosen communities behind a walled garden. And understand that there are a lot of different contexts out there. So there are some places, I mean, if you live in, 1950s Soviet sphere, well, samizdat, just being able to get stuff around, might be pretty important, but in 2008, it's not about samizdat anymore. It's not that there's no channel for communicating the information. It's a question of how publicly available and valuable that is. So in some places, simply having back channel, walled garden ways for people to mobilize and organize and find those fellow travelers is important. But as good as that might be, it still means that there's not enough freedom in the society to support widespread, publicly visible discourse. So I just wanted to point out that difference between private mobilization and public. You don't really get healthy, I think, until you have a lot of public discourse where even if it is, you do have the presence of a lot of voices that might not be the ones that you support coming from pro-government or right-wing or whatever it is. You nonetheless have the ability, the voices that counter that out there in the game.
Thanks, John. We have another question from Jed Miller.
Okay. Hi. I'm Jed.
Actually, what I'd like to do is take three questions. So if anyone else has questions, we'll take the first one from Jed, and meanwhile, a second question in the back there. And anyone else? Okay, we'll start with those two then.
I guess this question is for Evgeny or for anyone, because he used the word ecosystem.
So, John.
Well, here's the question. Internet boosters who talk about transformation of society through the internet don't like to talk about the fact that so many of these amazing moments happen at a very specific moment in history for a very specific reason, sometimes over the course of just a day or a few hours, because of a need that is offline and contextual. So I'm wondering, besides the mainstream media getting excited about it for a few days and saying, oh, look, here's another example of the internet doing something, and then the story sort of drifting away again, what can some of the tools and models you people have been talking about do to keep the story going? We have an example here in the U.S., for instance, of an amazing amount of attention online during the course of an election. And now there's all these questions about what can be done with that internet constituency, with that internet energy now. But without the election plastered over the television and other media, it's naturally going to dip down. So what are some of the models in play that can sustain this sense of a new way of doing things?
Thanks, Jed. Let's get the second question.
My name is Ann Nelson. We have a whole political system that has been built on a certain kind of hierarchy of information in which professional people work in content-providing institutions, starting with journalism, but also going to book publishing and other media. That business model is over. They're hemorrhaging profits and jobs. And so far, a lot of the revenue has been siphoned off by aggregators who are making money from the content that other people are working to create. I'd just like any comments you could make about the recent decision to have Google enter into an agreement with book publishers and start to address the revenue stream question. And first of all, how that will affect the atmosphere in the United States and then in other areas of the world.
I'm sorry, I think that question is really off the top. I mean, it's a fascinating question, and we should maybe do another panel about it, but it's really very far off the topic of this panel.
There is certain kind of activism that is created in different modes, and if one mode changes another mm-hmm. that has been dominant, I think mm-hmm. it fits into the political ecosystem in a complementary fashion. But okay. I leave it to you all.
Okay, so who'd like to start? Evgeny, maybe?
I can start with the first question. I think a lot of activism we've seen, and particularly online activism we've seen in this space, particularly in authoritarian states and societies, has been issue activism. It's a one-off activism, right? I mean, you organize a campaign, somebody's raising money, somebody needs an operation, you go raise money, then, you know, the whole sort of passion disappears, right? And there has been no platform, particularly, for example, in Russia, there has been no fundamental issue that could have aggregated all of those specific individual efforts right, and bring them under one umbrella, like, you know, the Barack Obama campaign managed to do here. There is no single, you know, I even think about it as an API, is also, if you're familiar with sort of, you know, the technology world, that's sort of a platform which can allow other platforms to grow on top of that. There has been no platform like this in Russia, unfortunately, right? So a lot of this activism is one-off and it disappears, and the only thing you can do next is try to remobilize the same groups after you got their contact details. It's still not very powerful as a means of mobilization, as a means of conducting activism. What we have seen, for example, is that because in Russia there is one dominant platform, which is LiveJournal, which powers a lot of these discussions in the public sphere, it's not just journalists and it's not just bloggers who read it. There are a lot of politicians, there are a lot of members of Duma, there are a lot of deputies, there are a lot of non-traditional sort of geeky blogging types who are online, who do maintain presence on LiveJournal. You know, and two or three deputies which are present on, you know, on LiveJournal make a tremendous difference because they understood that they can actually use it as a means of increasing publicity for themselves. So they've become sort of ambassadors to the blogosphere. So every single issue, well, I mean, most of the issues the bloggers are really concerned about, they would take and raise it with authorities. I'll give an example from last year. There was a very big campaign against a particular pharmaceutical company in Russia, which was trying to sell a very shady drug, which didn't really do anything but cost a lot of money. So bloggers organized a campaign to target that particular pharmaceutical company and flooded with, you know, bogus requests for delivery, flooded with, you know, they were sending fax copies of the Russian constitution to the fax numbers to destabilize their communication system. But what happened is that a lot of this activism was later harvested by, you know, a member of Duma who was blogging, who just took out that issue and very publicly said, I'm going to raise it with the prosecutor's office. And he did. And that gave a tremendous boost to the issue. It brought it to the national attention and brought it all often to the international attention. And I think the involvement of this non-blogging types helps. I mean, how do you make them involved in one platform is a very big question. In the US, I don't think it would work as well because the platforms are decentralized. You know, most people have standalone blogs and it doesn't necessarily follow that they have the same sense of community that Russians have on LiveJournal. And this sense of community creates this pressure and drive to sort of, you know, become active.
John?
So I'm going to try and actually draw a connection between those two questions. So what, and it comes back to, I'll use as a basis Ethan's remark about the kind of latent power of the bloggers that aren't blogging about politics. So you need to have if you can keep a healthy, let's call it the latent network, in terms of politics, maybe the dark matter, the people that aren't always talking about politics, or it's not their specialty, but there's a healthy, rich ecosystem with enough of this oxygen, meaning also the ability to interact with a press and more professional, validated forms of knowledge as we are accustomed to in the last media era. That's part of oxygenating this network, both so that the power of what can happen there doesn't just die away when a particular moment in time has passed. It's a latent capacity. But I think part of that, and this is to Anne's question, part of that involves maintaining some kind of hierarchy of information. And I don't agree that that era is completely dead, although I agree it is radically challenged right now. But no longer is it that there are only certain authoritative voices that can muster the capital or state control to get big megaphones to talk to society. But nor is it the case that they're completely gone. We haven't disintegrated into some kind of gray goo of just person-to-person communications. We still have hierarchies of knowledge and information that are, in fact, at least in the U.S. and some other contexts, maintained by bloggers. Bloggers play a role in this. I mean, you do have specialty networks of practice like those foreign policy expert bloggers. Those folks are linking to foreign policy journals. I mean, they're part of an ecosystem with these elite sources of information. And if those elite sources of information, the journal that you might hope that your comment or idea gets in someday, or that you might get invited to write for, to feel the reflected glory and the actual social capital benefits that might bring you, if those things fade away, the magazines, the journals, this professional media, that removes oxygen from the system. So you need to find a way to keep them there, but they're no longer the only players in town. But keeping them there, having them in interaction, I think, is to Yevgeny's point, you know, if members of the Duma read this and journalists read this and they know that there is a site where they can all interact and their opinions mix and meld and they want to impress one another, if there's a site for discourse, that's what gives the oxygen. And I think all these different factors we're talking about play a part in maintaining that healthy environment.
So what I thought was really interesting about that pair of questions is that they both sort of address issues having to do with overhype and overpromise within this space. And one of the things that I'm finding very interesting, I'm sort of looking at some of the cyber utopian rhetoric of about 15 years ago and sort of looking back and seeing what's come true and what hasn't come true. And what's wonderful is any technology comes into play, people immediately predict that it's going to destroy society. They also predict that it's going to have us all hold hands and sing Kumbaya. Neither ever comes about. What's actually interesting is how quickly we're able to sort of close that circle and come out with a real evaluation. What's very interesting in the blogosphere is that we're somewhat ahead of the curve. I think within 5 years, rather than the usual 15 to 20, we're actually starting to get much, much more realistic about what we can and can't do within this space. So to Jed's question, I think a lot of people are stepping way back from this belief that somehow participatory media is going to lead to direct participatory democracy all the time. And I think John is right on that. I think what it really is a latent capability. We need these structures because in emergency situations, we're then able to lean on them. One of my favorite examples on this, in the wake of Katrina, I found myself working on a project to try to enter in a huge amount of data. All of the data that sort of ended up on these random bulletin boards of people saying, hey, you know, I had to flee New Orleans. Now I'm in this town. I'd really like to find my friends. So hundreds and hundreds of thousands of rows of data that needed to be entered into a structured database. We ended up getting it done in about 16 hours. And the way we did it was by using my wife's list of friends on LiveJournal. So folks who really like sitting around talking about J.J. Abrams television shows, we were suddenly able to sort of activate that social network and gain thousands and thousands of human hours out of just sort of figuring out a way to activate that. So the thing that I would want to remind you on that is that these networks are going to be banal somewhere between 97 and 99.5% of the time. But you still have to take them very, very seriously because at that moment where they're necessary, one of the great genius of this sort of next generation of people building these networks is they know how to activate those networks and bring them into play when need be. They're just not going to do it the vast majority of the time. On Anne's point, I want to push back real hard. People are making a terrible mistake in assuming that gatekeepers are out of the game. I actually think there's sort of a resurgence in appreciation and an enthusiasm for gatekeeping of one fashion or another. I think one of the things that people are discovering are that in a world where everyone can speak, it's actually very, very important that people edit and that people find ways to filter their way through this. Yes, absolutely, there are real challenges to existing journalistic and publishing models, but that tends to be radically overstated. If you look at where people tell you where they're getting their news, the majority of young people in large surveys will still tell you that they're getting it from the evening news, particularly from local broadcast news. And it's sort of shocking to discover that in the average week, someone between 18 and 35 will tell you that they have a 69% chance of getting something from the evening news and only about a 50% chance to get it from the internet. It goes counter to all these different ways we think about it. But I think what's happened for a lot of new media activists like myself is that we no longer really expect that we're going to create a brave new independent citizen-edited gatekeeper-free medium that's going to somehow become the blogger version of CNN. It was a really nice idea when Dave Weiner put it forward in 2004. It's not going to happen. What's happening instead is that people who are doing citizen media are figuring out how to use this as an input into existing media. We see it as a backdoor to get ideas within there, and we also see that media is adapting very, very quickly to incorporate the stuff that we're doing. When we work on these things at Global Voices and try to figure out how do we bring blogs into newspapers, we are simultaneously thrilled when a newspaper sort of figures out how to incorporate our content on their website and in their paper, but we also realize that they're probably going to put us out of business because they've got a better revenue model, as screwed up as it is, than we do. So I actually think what's likely to come out of this are different publishing models, some refinements on those models that are already going on. But I think in many cases, they're going to be picking over the corpses of really interesting web experiments that may not figure out how to actually make money off of it, but figure out how to create new models and new technologies that actually get adapted by existing businesses that have things like, oh, customers and revenue.
If you have any 1 minute.
Okay, well, I'll try to be quick. On aggregators specifically, I think there is some sort of confusion about the role and the business model that many of these news aggregators have. I think you have to realize that they do play an important and extremely important role, for example, in Russia, where if not for one particular meme tracker and blog search engine called Yandex Blogs, there wouldn't be any online activism in Russia. You know, and I'm ready to subscribe to this message. And I'm absolutely sure that without this platform, which brings the most popular and interesting campaigns to the attention of the public, there would be no campaigning in Russia. There would be no online activism as we know it now. So, you know, the role is definitely positive. But the notion that the news aggregators are somehow making it harder for the newspapers to survive, I think it's also a very misleading way to look at things. No news aggregators make money. I mean, I'm sorry to sort of make it public, but Google News is not making any money from the aggregation, and neither do most of the other aggregators. Why? Because there is no business model. Most of the aggregators operate is by sending people away from their own website. You know, and if you think about it as your leading activity, that's not a very good way to make money from advertising. Because, you know, people are interested to leave your site the moment they get in, right? So I think we sort of tend to blame the messenger here. But, I mean, all the aggregators do is sort of amplify this oxygen, which John is talking about. If there is no oxygen in the system to speak of, you know, at the beginning, then there will be nothing to amplify. So, but I think it is wrong to blame the aggregators, because the aggregators, if anything, actually make it easier for the audiences to discover that content. Who will pay for the production of that content is a much different question. But taxing aggregators, which don't make any money in the first place, would not get us anywhere, I think.
Okay, thanks, Evgeny. Just to kind of close off, round off the discussion, it seems to me there have been two clusters of questions and tentative answers that we've been hearing in the last hour and a half. One has to do with how civil society is self-organized on the web, in the network public sphere. How they interlink to one another, how they form enclaves, how they link to global civil society and news streams and communication streams outside of their own societies, and how also there's this recurring question of, on the one hand, you have these kind of hedonistic, inward-looking, seemingly trivial forms of congregation and communication online. When do those suddenly toggle into something political and civic? And over the last few years, we've seen a number of really interesting examples of that happening. So that's one cluster of questions. A second one has to do with how states are responding to this challenge. We've seen some examples of really blunt reactions, like just shutting down the system. Less blunt approaches, like what the Burmese government has been doing in the last few months, hiring mercenaries to take down sites they don't like. And then an emerging set of much more interesting, nuanced, complex ways of dealing with this challenge, particularly in China and Russia. China uses a combination of highly granular, very sophisticated censorship, and also sticks, essentially, and also carrots, making dissent seems somehow socially deviant and uncool and unattractive. In Russia and the Russian-speaking blogosphere and public sphere, we've seen attempts to co-opt it and to manipulate it and use the kind of pleasure-seeking drive and hedonistic instincts of people roaming online to bolster the legitimacy of the state. And I think so far, these are early days. These are phenomena that are just emerging, and we'll have to have a lot more discussions to track this over the coming years. So a big thank you to all four of our panelists, and thanks to the audience.